Hello, you. How's it going? Oh, I shouldn't say that. I think that's somebody else's punchline from some sitcom a long time ago or something, isn't it? Sorry, I take that back. Hey, guys. And ladies. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to my show. This is the Scott Horton Show. Well, I got a ton of invites out, and I'm kind of disappointed that I don't already have at least three interviews lined up for you guys. Only two. But on the other hand, I'm really glad because I got so much news to cover today on so many different subjects. I couldn't fit this many interviews in the show to get to it all. And well, I like talking about stuff. So I will have a great interview. It's guaranteed to be great. With Chris Woods, who's now at airwars.org. We're going to find out all about that. What is airwars.org? He was formerly with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. He's the author of the book that I have on the pile here, Sudden Justice, that I haven't read yet because I'm terrible. And then also, Les Ackland will be on the show. Did you guys see this thing? We ran it on antiwar.com. I sent a tweet out to people. The article is called Obama Pledged to Reduce the Nuclear Arsenal. Then came this weapon. And it's the B-61-12 H-bomb. With a satellite guidance kit on its tail. And an adjustable yield. It literally has a hatch with a dial on it. Can adjust a yield. And anyway, this article is the most best article I have ever read about the nuclear weapons industrial complex in America. Their lobbying, their political pressure, their revolving door, iron triangle, if you want to call it that, that guarantees that America maintains a policy that guarantees their money to make H-bombs. And this guy, Les Ackland, get this, he's the former editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists magazine. So, and this thing's like 5,000 words, and I really should have reread the whole thing this morning. I read the whole thing the other day. I think as I'm talking about it, parts of it are coming back to me. And I'll scan through during the commercials and try to take a few more notes. But I already know mostly what I want to ask him about. And yeah, man, it's something else. I'll tell you what. You know, it's funny because, it's true. Just like any other special interest group in America, no different in any way. The guys that make the H-bombs, and they lobby for their own wealth and power and access and whatever, just as any agribusiness firm would do, just as any bank would do, or any arms dealer. That's how business is done in America. That's what you do. And their argument, of course, you don't even have to ask them for their comment. You already know what their comment is. Hey, it's a democracy. If the American people and their leaders don't want to have a nuclear weapons policy, that's perfectly fine with us. But as long as they do, we want to make the best H-bombs we can make. So, anyway. It's amazing. You would think that some kind of morality, some kind of vision of the interests of the nation beyond just their own selfish parochial welfare needs would, I mean, we're talking about H-bombs. You think I'd kind of kick in there somewhere. They would have to think of that somewhere. No, they're no different than any other industry, any hardware manufacturer who's trying to sell his widget to the Pentagon. We'll do whatever it takes to be able to reach his hand into that honeypot. It's really incredible. Really incredible stuff. It's Len Ackland. I wrote down Les, so I better not call him Les. God dang, Horton. Pay attention. Len Ackland is going to be on the show today. All right, now, So, things I gotta talk about. Let me get started on them. First of all, what time is it? Okay, good. So, the New Yorker has run a thing now about Darren Wilson. A very delightful little profile about Darren Wilson, the murderer cop that murdered Mike Brown. And, you know, I got to the part where they're like, oh, here's the story of his mommy and daddy and where he came from and whatever about, I don't know, 100 words into the thing. And then I just quit. A couple hundred words into it. And, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just not going to dignify that with my eyeballs. Thanks, New Yorker, anyway, for trying. But, so for my part, I get to push back on that a little bit. So here's a few things for, about Mike Brown that I think you should know. First of all, well, geez, there's so many different first of alls, I kind of don't know where to begin. But I guess first of all, Darren Wilson admitted that he did not make the connection whatsoever between the call for somebody stole some cigars from the store and here's a black guy walking down the street. That was in his own admission. So that has nothing to do with it. All that happened was a guy was walking down the middle of the street, damn near the very end of the neighborhood and, you know, the cul-de-sac, the end of the road here, not out in the middle of a big, you know, double yellow stripe main road at all. On a Saturday morning or Sunday morning, whichever. Saturday morning, I guess it was. And the cop comes up and picks a fight with him, basically for no reason whatsoever. And then, if you go to Vox.com, and I hate to say that, I know that sounds ridiculous to say, but go to Vox.com, and they have a rundown with Mike Brown's best friend's story of what happened that day, and Officer Wilson's story of what happened that day. And they both agree on the timeline of what happened, almost exactly. It's just in all the details and the spin where they differ. And if you read the two stories side by side, it's so easy to tell how self-serving Darren Wilson is and how, you know, basically honest, or at least trying to do his best to tell the story of what happened, Mike Brown's friend is. I mean, they tell the sequence of events in the same way, but the spin is just completely ridiculous. And the worst case of confirmation bias probably in history, you can find every conservative in the whole country saying, oh yeah, but even Eric Holder said, and so therefore, poor little Darren Wilson. Well, I'm sorry, but F Eric Holder. Oh, but Scott Horton, he's well known for being a Negro. Uh-huh. And even he said that Mike Brown had it coming. Yeah, well, I don't care what Eric Holder says. Eric Holder is a criminal. Eric Holder should be in prison for obstruction of justice in the case of Kenneth Trenadue. He should have never got a chance to be the Attorney General of the United States in the first place. Eric Holder is a criminal worse than Darren Wilson. Why the hell would I take his word for anything? Unless it confirms my bias, I guess, then I say even Eric Holder admits. But in this case, Eric Holder hasn't really done a thing, and the Department of Justice hasn't really done a thing to refute the basics of the case. And they admit that the cop shot 12 times. Well, when and where? He was shooting at Mike Brown as he was running away. So he turned around. And I don't care if some people admit that, no, I didn't really see his hands up, but I heard other people saying that, and so I thought I should say it too. I saw the workmen, the white repairmen in the neighborhood at their work truck telling CNN, yeah, he turned around with his hands up like, hey, you know, enough, I'm not armed. I forgot their exact words, but they, like, mimicked it. Anyway, and then the other thing was the desecration of his body, leaving him out in the hot sun for hours without covering him with a blanket. And then the hardcore military police state crackdown that night over the protesters. And then I'm out of time, so I can't finish a damn thought on the show ever. Sorry.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, guys, welcome back. Sorry, man, I'm going too long about certain things, but I wanted to wrap up a couple of more things about that real quick. First of all, in the tale of the struggle between Darren Wilson and Mike Brown, as always, the war party likes to truncate the antecedents. Oh, Mike Brown tried to grab his gun. Really? Tried to grab his gun out of his holster or out of his hand? You're telling me that Darren Wilson had already pulled his gun on Mike Brown for what? For being bumped into by Darren Wilson's door? And then, so if a cop pulls his gun on you for no reason whatsoever, you're out of your mind to try to grab it, to try to grab his hand to prevent him from killing you? No, one should always, only in that situation, lie down on the ground and just trust that he's probably not going to murder you, even though he's just drawn his gun on you for no reason whatsoever, or no good enough reason to draw his gun. One thing that the New Yorker points out about Darren Wilson in the first couple of hundred words I read before I quit is he's 6'4 and 200 and something pounds of muscle, too. He is not some twerp cop. He was, should have been perfectly capable of, you know, at least beginning this confrontation without drawing his firearm. So people say, oh my God, yeah, Mike Brown's DNA on the gun. Yeah, well, so he tried to grab the gun. Somebody pulled a gun on him. So in order to try to avoid getting shot to death, he, you know, apparently grabbed it. The gun went off. He took off running. I guess that's the story, right? The gun went off and, like, hit the door from the inside or some shit. I forget. Close enough. Didn't hit either of them, that first shot. He takes off running. The cop's still shooting at him as he's running away. So he turns around and surrender, and he just gets killed to death. Shot, I think it was 4 times. And what Darren Wilson, the cop, told the grand jury, I swear to God, this is true. You can go and look in the transcripts. He told the grand jury that it, he referred to Mike Brown as it. He said, it almost, nice qualifier here, turned into a demon. It turned into a demon. You know, almost. And it bulked up to run through the bullets. What? To run through the bullets? But that's not how it works. Bullets go through people. How's a person supposed to go through a bullet when a person is so much bigger than a bullet is? It turned into a demon and bulked up to run through the bullets. So I had no choice but to fire my bullets, even though obviously I was in serious doubt as to whether my bullets would be able to stop the magical Negro who was using its magical demon powers against me. Oh yeah, I could definitely see a no bill there, huh? Well, what would you do if a magical, demonic black man was charging you? Had said, shoot him to death. I mean, I know what you're saying. Right hook, but no. Kill him. And I don't believe he was charging the cop anyway. He's charging a cop that's shooting at him as he's running away. He turns around to charge him. I don't believe it. I think he was turning around and saying, oh God, stop! Lucky he wasn't hit yet. But anyway, even Eric Holder says, So, never mind what makes sense. Let's see. This cop picked a fight, flipped out, shot a guy and killed him. A guy who was no threat to him whatsoever at the time that he killed him. Or, magical Negro lost its humanity, turned into an it, turned into a demon, and tried to bulk up. My God, it was like he gained 25 pounds of muscle right there in front of my eyes. As it bulked up to run through the bullets. You know what? That's a much more plausible explanation of what happened there that day, don't you think? Let me guess. If you're black, you think, what? No, of course not. And if you're white, then you're supposed to think, well, yeah. Because I saw that on TV. Right? This is not an issue of a murderer versus a civilian. Yeah, murderer government agent versus a civilian. It's purely a racial issue. Anyway. Yeah. And then I love the New Yorkers. Like, you know what? Let's go find out what makes this poor Darren Wilson guy tick. Tell us your side of it. Only. All right, enough. 25 years since the beginning of Desert Shield. Tom Knapp has a blog entry at antiwar.com. He was a Marine back then, I believe it was. And went to the war. I forget now if he ever told me if he was actually killing people in the war or not. I tend to think not. He writes in the blog entry how caught up in it he all was, and now looking back, and how it was the good war. Yeah, the second Iraq war, that one sucked. But the first one was great, but no, the first one led to the second one. And the second one was really just chapter two of the first one, chapter three. Bill Clinton waged war against Iraq the whole time. The conclusion of the first Gulf War was no conclusion at all. He compares it to World War II, the other good war. He says, yeah, except that the other good war led immediately to the Cold War. And all these other consequences going forward. Same thing with the Gulf War. Huh. Maybe there are no good wars. The fact that we've been bombing Iraq for 24 and a half years at this point, I admit they sort of took a break there between 2011 and 13 and 14. A couple of years off. But still. If you've been bombing a country for 24 and a half years, what's a couple of years vacation from that? Not much for them, I don't think. And when your country's been bombing another country for a quarter of a century, maybe it's time to ask yourself whether it's accomplishing what your political leaders told you it would accomplish. Whether these are people that you should need to continue believing in for any reason or what or not. Even Bill Hicks, right? Could have won that war with 80 guys. But missed the aftermath. But now, look, now we got to contain Saddam forever. Well, he was ahead of his game for back then. But, yeah, man. So, anyway, there's that. And then what time is it? Okay, I don't have time to get to my next subjects yet. Music's playing. I got to go to this break. But when we get back, I've got Iran. I've got ISIS war stuff, Palestine, Yemen, and then more police state stuff, too. Quite a bit more. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hang around. ScottHorton.org/chat if you want to hang around in there with those guys. Hey, guys. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Okay, kids, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Tomorrow, Michael Meharry is going to be on the show to talk about some victories against the national government, trying to nullify and interpose with the state governments. You try. You do what you can. They're getting work done that way. So that's good. Sorry for sniffling in your ears there. All right. Oh, man. I don't even know where to begin with all this. You got the turkey curd thing, but then you got the, the big headline right now. Wait, there's something else I was forgetting to say. What is it going to be? I don't know. Stop by my website, scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Read what I'd have you read at antiwar.com. All right. So CNN, I don't know why this is not the ongoing thing. Well, this is another important story right now. Never mind. Anyway, CNN reported that Obama has signed off on air cover for the rebels. Well, now, so we've seen that the DOD vetted. There were only 60 of them, Division 30. The vetted and trained by the DOD, never mind the ones trained and vetted by the CIA, who already been captured and or killed and taken over by the On This Were Front a year ago. These guys, as soon as they crossed the border into Syria, Nusra grabbed them and all their stuff. And they were supposedly there to, they're going to take it to ISIS. And then I love this from the New York Times. This wasn't supposed to happen like this. Check this out. In fact, officials said on Friday, I'm reading this from the New York Times, kids, okay? This is not from some communist propaganda rag. Which you can read some pretty good foreign policy stuff in communist propaganda rags. But anyway, this is a more of a fascist propaganda rag. The New York Times, the newspaper of record, all the news that's fit to print, the most official sources. In fact, officials said on Friday they expected the Nusra Front to welcome Division 30 as an ally in its fight against the Islamic State. You know what? I swear to God they changed that. News diffs, help me out, buddy. Where you at? I think they changed it, dude. Where you at, news diffs? Hang on. We're going to solve this case right now. Did you guys know about news diffs? Whenever the New York Times rewrites their propaganda, these guys keep track of all the changes. So let's see what they changed here about the allies. Where's the allied part? Man. Welcome. How about welcome? Sorry. Well, I'm doing it live on the thing. Captured 6 fighters of Division 30. Witnesses said. They took them to surprise. Took them by surprise. They did not expect. They said they expected them to welcome them as an ally. Wasn't supposed to happen like this. Okay. Well, maybe not. The green is. Oh, the green is the later version. Yeah, the green is the later version. The red is the part that they got rid of. So wait a minute. So yeah, the part where they expected Nusra to greet them as an ally is the new part. But I think the rewrite, I think it originally said, you know, it was much more personal where it was the senior officials expected for Nusra to, you know, they expected them to act like an ally kind of thing. You know what I mean? I mean, it's sort of the same thing, but pretty much only kind of. I don't know if they have the original version on this news diffs. Maybe they don't, or maybe I just got it wrong. But whatever, close enough. Expecting Nusra to welcome their guys as allies is not much different than saying, yeah, we consider them our allies. That is Al-Qaeda in Syria. Officials said on Friday they expect the Nusra Front to welcome Division 30 as an ally in its fight against the Islamic State. Wasn't supposed to happen like this. We wanted our guys to be allies with al-Nusra. In case you're just tuning in for the first time in years in your life or something, the Nusra Front, that's Al-Qaeda in Syria. This entire damn war. I was just telling you, we've been bombing Iraq for 24 and a half years. The last, 14 of them or whatever, 12 of them, 13, in the name of preventing Al-Qaeda from having safe haven or weapons there. Even though they never did until America invaded there. But anyway, now they are outright, even in the New York Times, even in Foreign Affairs. In Foreign Affairs. Openly, in Foreign Affairs, they're openly arguing for it. And the New York Times are openly admitting that that is the plan. That is the American policy. Assad must go. We really don't like the Islamic State, though. So what does that leave us with? Al-Qaeda. And their leader, Golani al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda in Syria, he did this interview with Al Jazeera, which is, Qatari, and it was a very kind of fluffy interview. They interviewed him for 45 minutes. And they, I guess, had asked him to please renounce Zawahiri, and he said no. He wouldn't do it. And in the interview, he praises Zawahiri and says, now he promises not to attack the West because I guess Al-Qaeda leadership has decided that for now they want to focus on fighting in Syria and get to us later or something. But so... I mean, what are we talking about? Even at the Daily Beast, they ran a thing saying, you've got to be kidding, man. Facepalm. That was the headline at the Daily Beast. Facepalm. No, Al-Qaeda is not our ally. Does anyone have to be told that? But anyway, that's the policy. Why? Because Israel and Saudi and Turkey and Qatar hate Assad. And because the neocons and the Israel firsters in America hate Assad because Israel hates Assad. And so America can't say, look, obviously Assad is horrible, but we're not going to back Mujahideen against a secular, clean-shaven, chin-having, three-piece suit-wearing fascist like him. That's not a call to back him, but to back Al-Qaeda against him? It's crazy. And, as much as people want to make the Syrian war a sectarian thing, most Syrian Sunnis, and they're 70% of the population, and much better than 50% of that population, support Assad, or at least not him as a person. They probably don't, but they support the Syrian military and the Syrian state, especially as compared to what promises to replace it. So, yes, it's true that virtually all the fighters for Nusra, for the Islamic State, and then the other smaller, CIA-backed groups and whatever are all Sunnis. But that doesn't mean that all Sunnis are on their side. They're not. And really, they've already lost this war this whole time. I mean, it's just a no-win grind. As the Israelis bragged about it, and... this was, again, in the New York Times, a newspaper record. It was not even, they told it to Jody Ruderin, the Jerusalem bureau chief, that, yeah, what we prefer is for neither side to win and for it to just be a long, slow grind and every side lose forever or whatever kind of thing. Nothing cynical or horrible about that. But Assad holds on to all the major cities. I mean, al-Nusra has taken Idlib, but that's kind of a small town. The state army still has the backing of the population. And you might ask why. It's because America's side are the suicide bomber prisoner beheaders, whether it's al-Nusra, the so-called FSA, or the Islamic State that we're fighting too. I guess I'll admit that. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Yeah, so anyway, Obama says he's now going to provide air cover. Well, we said we're going to train up 5,000 troops, and that means never mind what the CIA had already done, but just the DOD kind of starting a brand new project again. We're going to train up 5,000 troops, so they trained up 60. And then they sent them in, and a few ran away while the rest got captured. Captured by al-Nusra. So now what does Obama do? Instead of saying, see guys, look, man, I'm sorry, but the moderates, they're a fantasy. There's just no moderates to back there. The rebel field is dominated by al-Nusra. It always has been. And so enough of this crap. And you know what? It's just because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants anyway. And he can go back al-Qaeda if he wants, but we're not going to forget this. Instead, what does he do? At least according to CNN, he has now authorized the U.S. Air Force to run as air cover for the rebels. But who does he mean? Hey, here's the rebels in Syria. The Islamic State and al-Nusra. And the rest of this is mostly a fantasy. And the rest of the groups that claim their independence from al-Nusra and the Islamic State, they fight with at least Nusra, if not the Islamic State, all the time. Trade weapons with them. Money, resources, men, material, tow missiles. American arms that the Americans have given to these or those groups have time and again been found in the hands of al-Nusra, which is, again, simply al-Qaeda in Syria. So what does that mean we're going to be flying air cover for them? Does that mean we're putting in American special forces with them? Probably not. They don't want to have an Ambassador Stevens type stab in the back thing there. Somebody must have learned one lesson from that day, right? So what are they going to do? They're going to drop laser pointers to al-Qaeda in Syria and say, go ahead and point us out who you want us to kill? And the U.S. Air Force will be flying and hitting targets designated by Golani's men, by Ayman al-Zawahiri's men. Really? I mean, I want to say you got to be kidding, but we've had years of this, you know, one degree or another this whole time. But this is crazy. You know, Charles Lister, who is the jihadist expert at the Brookings Institution, he wrote a thing saying, you know, I don't know, maybe, and it's like 7,000 words long about maybe back in al-Qaeda, and then at the end he goes, no way, dude. That's freaking al-Qaeda, man. What are you going to do? You going to back them? No. And then he saw this, and I saw him on Twitter saying, you've got to be freaking kidding me. In the New York Times, senior administration officials, we expected for al-Qaeda to greet us as allies. Didn't work. Here from the Daily Beast, we didn't kill ISIS, we made them stronger. So all that bombing them for a year has accomplished, just like I told you a year ago would happen. It's all they need is for America to come and bomb them for their public relations. Look at us, we're resisting the Americans. Oh, yeah, no, that's really complicated calculus, right? That's not basic arithmetic. Well, let's see. Can you win a war with just air power against a guerrilla movement? No. Can you strengthen one? Yes. You know what? That's really difficult. And then, of course, there's the entire crisis, which is just amazing. If you read, I love Patrick Coburn. I mean, here is an understated guy, right? And he can, you can tell when you're reading this thing, he is just absolutely flabbergasted by this stuff. And he ain't naive, but he's just saying, for God's sake, man. The Turks have said, okay, fine. The Islamic State set off a suicide attack against some Kurds inside Turkey, so you can use the Incirlik Air Base. As long as you're cool with us attacking the Kurds who've been fighting the Islamic State. And the Americans say, okay. And then they haven't flown a single flight out of the Incirlik base against the Islamic State yet. But the Turks have hit a handful of Islamic State targets. Probably gave a phone call first. Hey, we got to hit y'all a couple of times, but we'll try to miss here. It's a PR thing with the U.S., you understand. And then they've gone on and hit Kurdish targets in Iraq and in Syria and inside in the mountains inside Turkey. They started bombing the PKK, the YPG, and the PKK in Turkey and in Iraqi Kurdistan as well. Where the Iraqi Kurds, Barzani and Talabani, are telling the PKK, please go back to Turkey. We don't want you here. Which I guess that kind of bodes well in a way for, in a very cynical way, for, you know, at least when America's unleashed their ally, the Turks, against their ally, the Kurds, that they're not directly attacking the government of Iraqi Kurdistan and making an enemy out of them. And the PKK, I guess, are expendable enough to Barzani and Talabani there in northern Kurdistan. Who's been fighting the Islamic State in Syria? Not really al-Nusra, just a little bit. And there's not too much direct conflict between, or even contact, I guess is the word I'm looking for, between the what's left of the Syrian rump state, Assadistan, and the Islamic State. It's the Syrian Kurds who've been fighting them, the YPG communist militia. And America has been backing them up with airstrikes. Coburn says in here that, hey, when I was there in May, or was it March, that there was hardly a moment where you could not hear American aircraft in the sky picking targets and blasting them, helping back the Kurds against the Islamic State. And so now, you know, well, the whole goddamn thing's a mess, man. Now America's ally, the Turks, bombing America's allies, the Kurds. And so, you know, I don't know. It's easy, I guess. It's easier for me to say, well, you know, Obama's in charge of all of this. If he told his national security advisor to have the Secretary of Defense call the Turks and read them the riot act and say, no more support for jihad, and I really mean it, or else, what, no more military aid, the future of our NATO alliance, et cetera, real threats. He could get the Turks to fall in line. Is he even trying? And, you know, is it even plausible at all for any of us in 2015 to pretend to believe that the Americans, this whole time that they've been sending guns and money to certain groups in Syria, haven't recognized that all the money and guns are ending up in the hands of al-Nusra all along, and even the Islamic State? And yet they persist. Just 3 weeks ago, the President of the United States said Assad must step aside. In other words, never negotiate. Keep the war going. Continue to seek regime change on behalf of America's enemies. You know, I am not for, again, for the millionth time, and I've said this for 10 years straight, I'm totally against the idea of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush paying Bashar al-Assad to torture and murder jihadists for us. Should not have done that. Shouldn't have tortured innocent men, mistaken identity cases either. But shouldn't have been torturing and killing anybody. Should not have been working with him. That's part of what created this mess, backing all the dictators of the Middle East. Well, man, that doesn't mean back the jihadists against them. How about neither? Is that really, you know, an isolationist and juvenile point of view? Come on, Scott. We have to back someone in a war. There can't be a war that we're not backing one side or the other. You're just being childish. We have to back either Assad, the fascist torturer, mass murderer, or we have to back Al-Qaeda. So make up your mind. Anyway. U.S. trained Syrian rebels right about Al-Qaeda fleeing the Kurdish territory. Oh, I skipped that one. I already talked about that. I already mentioned this. Iraqi Kurdish government asked PKK fighters to get the hell out. And then look at this. PKK forces kill 3 troops in southeast Turkey. So the entire now Turkish civil war is going to start back up again. Seriously, like in when Bill Clinton used to pay the government of Turkey to wage war against the Kurdish population, killing tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands in the 1990s. Remember that? Yeah, George Clooney was crying all about it. Oh, no, he wasn't. It was because the Democrats were doing it. Sorry, it was fine. Don't worry about that. In fact, I think the only reason I know about it is because of Noam Chomsky from back then. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And on the line, I have Chris Woods. He is the author of Sudden Justice on the Drone Wars, and formerly with the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. He's now at airwars.org. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you?
I'm very good, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you back on the show. Hey, man, tell me all about Air Wars, first of all, here.
Well, we've been around almost as long, I suppose, as the airstrikes bombing Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. We were we set ourselves up shortly after they began back last August. I think there's been this obsession, really, with Western governments of these air-only wars recently, and all sorts of outrageous claims about how we don't kill civilians in these wars anymore. I don't personally believe that, based on years of covering conflicts, and we thought it important to start tracking the war. And then about 6 months in, we got some good funding from a charitable foundation here in the UK and have employed staff in Iraq and also in Europe. Who have been tracking claims of civilian casualties from those airstrikes. And we published our first big report on that today. And surprise, surprise, it turns out that the 2 civilians the coalition's so far admitted to killing, we've killed an awful lot more than that. It's looking like around 500 civilians killed so far in coalition airstrikes over the past year.
All right. Now, and that's in Iraq and Syria combined.
That's right, yeah.
All right. And now, so as far as the reports, it looks like there are 2 or 3 different ones here, right? One is civilian and friendly fire, but then the other is cause for concern. I guess one is for the year 2015, and one is for since the start of the war. Help me out.
So, yeah, we published 3 things today. The first is our overall report, which analyzes all of the airstrikes since last year. And that's a 30-page report you can find on our website. Then we've also published our complete data. So for both 2014 and 2015, you can go on our website and you can find every single incident where it's been alleged that civilians or friendly forces have been killed by the coalition. You'll find photographs, biographical evidence, videos, and links to every single claim of those reports. And also we grade them. We many of the reports are challenging, to say the least. They're often poorly reported or contested. We're not claiming that civilians died in all of these events, although we do think they died in many of them. And so you put all of that together, and I think it gives us the most comprehensive picture we've had yet about civilians killed by the coalition across these two countries. And that's still a fraction of the civilians being killed by the Assad regime, by the Iraq government, by so-called Islamic State, you know, which are killing civilians in their thousands in Iraq and Syria. But it is, you know, hundreds of dead civilians is an issue, we think. And it's certainly something our militaries and politicians need to be paying more attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so now, as you kind of began with the faith that these politicians have in air power, at least they have political faith in air power to show that they're doing something, even if it's not getting guys killed, which is what they're really afraid of at this point, which at least that's good that, you know, the populations of the Western countries have their leaders afraid. They're going back to this Bill Clinton cruise missile policy. But so the ineffectiveness, I guess, aside, maybe we can get back to the ineffectiveness of all this, or even the counterproductive nature of it all. But can you give us a ballpark of just how many strikes we're talking about, what percentage of the time they're killing innocent people? Because it doesn't sound like, you know, Nixon carpet bombing North Vietnam here.
Yeah, this is very different kind of warfare from that our parents and grandparents were used to. You know, air power used to be about indiscriminate slaughter. And in a sense, it still is for the Assad regime in Syria, for example. That's most civilians are killed in Syria by the Assad regime deliberately killing civilians in airstrikes. The kind of aerial warfare the West fights these days is quite different. We use precision munitions. And also, we don't carry out so many strikes. We don't need to carry out carpet bombing anymore because small numbers of bombs can usually achieve the same effect. So we've seen 6,000 airstrikes in the first year of the coalition's air war. And of those, we've identified around 140 potential incidents of concern. So around 6,000 airstrikes, we think 500 to 600 civilians killed in those. That's still a lot, but historically, you know, measured against other wars, that's a declining curve, I suppose.
And now, how hard do you have to dig to find all this? How forthcoming is the Empire about all this on their end?
Well, very unforthcoming, unfortunately. And one of the things we've done is to look at each of the 12 coalition members and see how transparent and accountable they actually are in their bombings. And of the 12, we found that only Canada regularly reports on where and when it's bombing in Iraq and Syria. Every other member of the coalition, and it's a steep sliding scale from the UK and the US, which are reasonably transparent, but have some significant failings, down to the bottom with countries like Australia and Bahrain, which report virtually nothing. And we think that's absolutely unacceptable, because as the coalition tells us, each country doing these bombings is individually liable for the civilians it kills in Iraq and Syria. So how can these affected civilians possibly have recourse to justice if nobody will tell them who bombed them? I mean, that's a ridiculous situation.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of which, you know, when you mentioned Canada participating in this, I mean, I think maybe most people remember that they didn't participate in Iraq War II. Now here they are, or two and a half, or whatever you call it. Now here they are for Iraq War III. And you mentioned Australia as well. Who else is actually in the coalition, actually flying planes, not just on paper, but participating in the war?
Yeah, so actually bombing in Iraq and Syria today, we have the United States, obviously responsible for the vast proportion of airstrikes. Then we have the UK, France, Belgium, Netherlands, Australia, Denmark, Canada, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and United Arab Emirates. And we've heard, obviously, recently Turkey started carrying out its own airstrikes. Turkey isn't part of the coalition, and we've recently been told that it's not cooperating with the coalition, really. So they're carrying out their own airstrikes on Islamic State and on the Kurds independently of the coalition. We also have Israel jumping in there as well. Israel carried out airstrikes in Syria just the other day. So it's turning into a free-for-all.
Against Hezbollah,
really,
or against the Islamic State?
That was against Hezbollah in Syria. So it is getting very complicated there right now.
All right. I'm talking with Chris Woods from airwars.com. And by the way, I owe you an apology for not getting to Sudden Justice yet. I got a pile of to read here that I'm just terrible at getting to. But it is, you know, on the top of the short pile. There are other bigger piles. So you could be in a worse spot, Chris. But
yeah, it's perfect beach reading, obviously, Scott. Who wouldn't want to read about drones and targeted killers?
Well, no, I do. It's just a matter of getting to it, I swear. Because, honestly, I mean, the reason I kind of interrupt the actual discussion here to talk about that is because I want to highlight your work for people and all that you did at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. There are very few who are, even attempting to do this kind of meticulous work that you're doing, tracking the deaths from the drone wars and, and that means in Afghanistan, or is it just Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, or is it Afghanistan too?
It is. Yeah, the book looks quite heavily at places like Afghanistan and Iraq as well, and tries to fill in that missing picture of what the drones have been doing on the regular battlefield as well.
Yeah, there you go. So this is a lot of really important work, and it doesn't get nearly the amount of attention that it deserves. So, you know, I hope people will go and check it out. And now, I guess all the stuff at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism is all still there on their site, right? And then plus there's the book, obviously. But as far as people accessing all this stuff online, do you have your own personal site, too?
No, I just airwars.org. People will
airwars.org. That's the new one. And that's the one we're talking today about, the new study on civilian casualties and friendly fire deaths. It's Chris Woods, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. You know, I hardly ever mention this because it pales in importance, really, to so many other aspects of it, but we are talking about a completely unauthorized, undeclared war being waged by the United States and its allies against the Islamic State right now. And you know what? Even in my ears, compared to, as we talked about, you know, I mentioned Vietnam there, that kind of thing, and 500 civilian casualties doesn't sound like that many, but of course, it all depends whose four-year-old is getting bombed to death, right? That's the question. As soon as you realize you're talking about individual human beings, then 500 is a huge number, right? Let's talk about that. Why don't you tell us some of the stories about who got bombed by the Americans crying whoops? Here, Chris.
Yeah, and Scott, I think you've really put your finger on it there. A lot of the casualties of these strikes, unfortunately, as so often in these wars, are women and children. You know, there's a comment from one of the generals running this air war that Islamic State wrapped itself around the civilian populations of Iraq and Syria, and that's where the coalition has had to go. And, you know, this is a different kind of war than we were fighting in Afghanistan, which is a mostly rural country, poorly populated country. Most of the airstrikes in Afghanistan, for example, were targeted strikes. They were planned. What we're seeing in Iraq and Syria is targets of opportunity. This is aircraft hunting for targets in the towns and cities of Iraq and Syria. And unfortunately, that's where the civilians are getting killed. And I have to say, you know, some of the material our researchers are having to deal with here in Iraq and in Syria is some of the worst I have ever seen. Some of the most graphic, some of the most violent. You know, just too many pictures of dead kids coming out of these airstrikes. And I think it is pretty disgraceful for the coalition not to be more forthright about those people it's actually killing when it makes mistakes. Because you can absolutely bet that Islamic State, that al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda faction out there, they are making propaganda out of these civilian deaths. And the coalition response is to stick its head in the sand and pretend they're not happening. And I don't think that's doing them any favors whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, so can you tell us some of the stories about, you know, the ones that you uncovered?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just ourselves. Of course, there are other monitoring groups in Syria and in Iraq. I mean, one of the worst was a temporary prison in Syria, which the U.S. actually bombed in December, on December 28th of last year. They hid that fact for 2 weeks. They didn't admit that they'd actually bombed this location. And in fact, it took the news agency McClatchy a lot of pressure on CENTCOM before they finally admitted it was them. On that occasion, we think at least 58 civilians died. It was an Islamic State building, but it was also being used as a temporary prison. It was full of men and women and teenagers who'd been picked up for petty crimes by Islamic State, for things like smoking on the street or not having a beard. And these poor men and women were in this temporary prison, and the U.S. put a bomb through the roof. And we think 58 civilians killed on that occasion. Another terrible event in Iraq just a few weeks ago, on June the 3rd, at a place called Hawija in Iraq, where the U.S. again bombed an IED factory, an improvised explosive device factory, where Islamic State was making bombs to send out and kill people. Unfortunately, there was so much explosive on the scene that the secondary explosions that came from that attack decimated the entire neighborhood. And in fact, one of the survivors has described his neighborhood as looking like it had been hit by a nuclear bomb. And when you see the photographs, you know exactly what he means. And the estimates from that strike are up to 70 civilians killed in that one event. Now, we still don't know the exact number, but we do know that CENTCOM has now launched a formal investigation and has conceded that civilians almost certainly died in that event. So we do know on that one they are paying attention. But on so many other events that we looked at, sometimes it's just one or two people. Often, other times it's dozens. You know, we've identified 140 events. We know that CENTCOM has investigated 10. That's a ridiculous gulf between the public understanding and what CENTCOM's actually doing about it.
Yeah. And now, so what's the proportion of strikes in Iraq compared to Syria? I guess mostly in Syria it was all centered around helping the YPG fight in Kobani, right?
Yeah, and initially it was about 50-50 between Syria and Iraq. And there was, of course, a huge number of airstrikes went into Kobani, as you say, helping the YPG. More than 1,000 of all the airstrikes in Iraq and Syria took place on Kobani over that three-month period. Since then, or at least until the last month, airstrikes in Syria really dropped away. Partly that's because America's allies pretty much deserted it in Syria. All of the Arab nations switched their attention to Yemen, and they've been bombing the crap out of Yemen for the past few months and killing an awful lot of civilians there, by the way. So the U.S. has been pretty much on its own in Syria since the new year. Almost 100% of airstrikes in Syria are by the U.S. only. The tempo in Syria has really picked up, though, again in the last month. We have seen the Arab nations starting to bomb again, and Canada has carried out a couple of airstrikes recently in Syria again. And unfortunately, no surprises really, the reports of civilian deaths have also started to track upwards as well. I mean, there's just a direct correlation. You bomb more, you kill more civilians. It's that simple.
Yeah. All right. Now, so now there's short-term gains to be pointed at here, but then, of course, the question is it worth that at all? I mean, assuming the premise of the war in the first place. But you could point to American airstrikes helping the YPG in keeping the Islamic State out of Kobani as, you know, being effective. Air power on its own, just hunting and killing targets, as you talked about, that's not really going to help. But in terms of backing up militias on the ground with air power, that makes sense. If we're backing militias, say, for example, Shiite militias in Fallujah being led by Iranians on the ground, they could win that tactical victory. You know, theoretically, if we drop enough bombs on their behalf, it seems, you know, like in Libya, like, at the end of the day, I guess eventually they'll take it. But then it still raises all kinds of further questions, though, about, like you said, the propaganda being used, or, you know, the effect of the killing of innocents in the propaganda, and the effect of, in that example, taking the side of the Shia or taking the side of the communist Kurdish fighters there, and how that plays into the Islamic State's narrative about why the Sunnis of former Iraq and Syria need them, because it's America and the Shia and the Israelis against us, and these kinds of narratives, and then we just go and prove them right, and we don't hit them hard enough to destroy them. That would take invasion or nukes, so we can't do that. And so instead we bomb them just enough to make them more powerful. And that's even Kimberly Dozier, who's pretty much got a Pentagon point of view a lot of the time, here writing for the Daily Beast, says, we didn't kill ISIS. We made them stronger. That's all we've done is help them solidify their position over the last year of this. So 500-something dead civilians for nothing, Chris.
Well, I think that's a really strong argument. And the Human Rights Watch has done some really important work on this about the power vacuum on the ground. When you have these air-only campaigns without, you know, your own forces on the ground, you've got to rely on proxies. And what Human Rights Watch has shown is that in Iraq in particular, what happens? Well, the coalition drives out Islamic State, and then who moves in and fills that vacuum? Shia militia, which are now occupying predominantly Sunni Muslim areas, and they want revenge. And what we're finding in many of these areas that the Shia militia are going into is they're committing war crimes. They're burning the villages to the ground. They're committing atrocities against the people, and they're ethnically cleansing. So, you know, some of the partners we have in this war are really problematic. Now, I know the coalition argues against that. They say, look, we've killed 15,000 Islamic State fighters in the last year. But then all the estimates say Islamic State is as strong today as it was a year ago. So does that mean we haven't killed 15,000 fighters, or that they can simply make more fighters than we can kill? And how are they making those fighters? What's radicalizing those people, those men in those areas of Iraq and Syria? That's a big question. Yeah. And, you know, we have a big problem here in Europe at the moment of European second, third generation Muslims drawn to Islamic State. What is that message that's drawing those people? What's the narrative Islamic State's able to play that radicalizes young men and women to draw them into this area, to recruit them to Islamic State and its values? I mean, that's a really difficult one for our politicians to answer, I think.
Right, because the answer is obvious. They don't even want to bring it up. The answer is obvious. When our governments kill their civilians, that's what it's always been since this time, 25 years ago onwards. That's what it's always been. And you know what? I've kept you overtime into this break, and I realize now that I was supposed to let you go more than 15 minutes ago, Chris. I'm very sorry. Thank you so much for your time, and come back on the show. It's great to talk to you. Please go ahead.
It's always a pleasure, Scott. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you. All right, y'all. That's Chris Woods. He's the author of Sudden Justice. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up today is Len Ackland. He is a former newspaper reporter and editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists magazine. And he wrote a book about the Rocky Flats nuclear bomb factory near Denver. Ain't that interesting? And that factory actually plays a part in this article. The article is at revealnews.org. Revealnews.org. The title, Obama Pledged to Reduce the Nuclear Arsenal. Then came this weapon, the B-61-12. Welcome to the show, Len. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. Thank you.
Very happy to have you on the show here. What is the B-61-12?
The B-61-12 is a guided nuclear bomb. It will be the first guided nuclear bomb in the U.S. arsenal, and it is currently being developed and tested at the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The B-61-12 is just, you know, one U.S. nuclear weapon, but its development really illustrates a much larger issue, which is the power and influence of the nuclear weapons industry, which has been rebranded or has rebranded itself in recent years as the nuclear enterprise. Mm-hmm. You'll recall that President Eisenhower warned the nation in his farewell address about the military-industrial complex, and you know, the story of the B-61-12 really talks about the military-industrial congressional complex.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so a lot of things to go over there already. First of all, just on the name, I thought when I read that in your article that that seems to me a big blunder on their part, even admitting they exist under any name, especially admitting to this sort of, you know, this concept of a military-industrial complex, but giving it the name Enterprise instead as some kind of chintzy euphemism, whereas before... At least in my mind, Len, I got to tell you, and I've been very cynical about American foreign policy for a long time, but it took a long time to really get through to me that the nuclear weapons lobby in America acts exactly in the same way as tobacco or big pharma or the banks and insurance companies or any other arms dealers that... As far as they're concerned, they would like to sell 1 million hydrogen bombs, and they will push to just, they don't care, you know, and maybe they'll even push to create a nuclear weapons policy friendly toward that end, just like any other industry would as well. But there's no limit on how many nukes they want to sell, and they don't look at it from any other point of view than that's their job, selling nukes. And they don't look at it from a, well, you know, come on, humans only need so many nukes, right, kind of point of view. But what I'm trying to get to is I think that most Americans are like me. They never even really imagine that you would have, like, the most cynical lawyer lobbyist kind of people up there lobbying, pushing to sell H-bombs. They figure that that is a demand-side equation only, where the military says exactly how many they need for defense purposes, but no other cynical conflicts of interest, you know, at all. So for them to say, well, okay, but we're not a complex, we're just an enterprise, to me is a huge admission, you know, that such a thing is even real. To me, it's a great talking point to point to for people to imagine what was previously probably unimaginable to them.
Well, you know, there's a lot unimaginable that, you know, have to do with nuclear weapons. You know, this week is the 70th anniversary of the United States having dropped two nuclear weapons of mass destruction on Japan. So two bombs, more than 200,000 people died in the short term. Many more died from radiation sickness after that. So, you know, it's a good time to reflect on, all right, now 70 years later, and particularly after President Obama and Cold Warriors, including Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, have all called for the elimination of nuclear weapons because of the high risk to the world. And yet, you know, the United States plans to spend some $348 billion, and that's just for starters, over the next 10 years to modernize U.S. nuclear weapons. So, you know, one of the questions that my colleague Bert Hubbard and I wanted to look at was, where is that going? Who's winning? Who's losing? And New Mexico, which 3 weeks ago, 70 years ago, in other words, July 16th, 1945, was where the very first atomic bomb of mass destruction was developed and tested. So, you know, it was a good time to look at the way the so-called Enterprise operates.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, as far as the B-61, back to that for just a second, because you guys are talking about how, you know, this is really, they've kind of exploited a loophole in the policy here where by making this, by basically adding a JDAM tail kit, sort of a satellite guided tail kit to what was previously a dumb ballistic bomb, right? And but what that means, though, is it's a giant shift, as you explain, in the usability of this weapon. I think you say it even has a dial on it where you can dial down the yield to acceptable for a politician to go ahead and hit the button on. Is that it?
Well, that's the concern. I mean, you know, this this bomb, you know, it's called a life extension program, and it's part of, it's supposed to be part of the notion that as long as nuclear weapons exist, we have to make sure that they are reliable, because now there are 9 countries with nuclear weapons, and you know, you don't want to encourage any of those countries to use such weapons. So the at the maximum explosive force of this bomb, it's 50,000 tons of TNT equivalent, but it can be dialed down, reduced to 300 tons. Now, the concern there from the experts, and you know, I'm a journalist reporting on this and not an expert, but the experts, you know, say, oh, you know, there's big concern here, because if the military argues that, all right, here is a 300 ton, you know, equivalent, with much less collateral damage, much less fallout, therefore, in a conflict, you might be able to use this bomb against a target without having radioactive fallout that would fall on your allies and friends, that could encourage the military to indeed recommend to a president that nuclear weapons be used. And once that were to happen, you know, there's great concern among everyone who's studied nuclear weapons that if nuclear weapons are again used, no one knows what the outcome is going to be. Yeah. You know, is that going to start a regional nuclear war, a global nuclear war? You know, because the 15,000 weapons that are out there, it's a good drop, and you know, we should all be happy that it's much less than the 64,000 peak that we hit back in the 80s. But still, those 15,000 weapons have the explosive equivalent of well more than 100,000 Hiroshima bombs. So, you know, we're not out of danger when it comes to nuclear weapons yet. You know, the Cold War ended, but the nuclear weapons age didn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, we just finished this interview with Chris Woods about the air war in Iraq, and previously he had done all this work on the drone wars. And part of that whole discussion is the lessons of Iraq War II are that the Americans really don't want to lose a bunch of infantry and Marines. But air war, sure. And so I worry that that argument that you just made about the usability of these tactical nukes and that kind of thing would have that much more play in that same, you know, post-Iraq War II era, where, man, mm-hmm. you really want to do a Bush-style invasion? Well, here's an alternative, Mr. President. I'm sorry. Hang on one second. We'll be right back, everybody, with Len Acklin. Wrote this great article about the nuclear weapons industrial complex. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Len Acklin about this great article. You really got to read this thing, man. I'm serious. It's at revealnews.org. Revealnews.org. Obama pledged to reduce nuclear arsenal. Then came this weapon. And then I love this quote. It's straight out of Henry Hazlitt, right? There's no question that the labs are a major portion of the economy, especially in Albuquerque and northern New Mexico. They employ thousands of people. And a little taste of the scene and not a question of the unseen there. But of course, we're talking about really Uncle Sam holding humanity hostage here with a gun to its head. You guys talk about, and I want to get to the revolving door stuff here in a second, but you guys bring up what Daniel Ellsberg has talked about on the show as well. Even a very limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan could mean what exactly for humanity?
Well, it could mean disaster. That has been shown. There are scientists who worked on nuclear winter back in the 1980s who have done recalculations. Brian Toon at the University of Colorado has worked with colleagues, and their analysis shows that if India and Pakistan, for example, were to fire 100 nuclear weapons at each other, that the explosions would generate so much, you know, dust and particles and crud into the air that in fact you would have a nuclear winter kind of outcome for the Earth, with a relatively small quote unquote nuclear war. So, you know, the nuclear weapons, I mean, just the idea that they're weapons is such a misnomer. I mean, these are devices that are made to for mass destruction. You know, they're not weapons in any common sense of the word. So, you know, it's something that that people, you know, forget about, don't think about, and yet they still, it's the greatest short-term risk to the planet, because if there were a you probably remember this back in the 80s, we used to talk about fast death and slow death. So people who worked on nuclear weapons issues worked on fast death. In those days, we thought about, you know, 15 or 20 minutes before launch time. So that for my generation was you know, the constant nuclear fear. Slow death was environmental degradation. Well, these days, you know, I think a lot of people pay attention to climate change and global warming and environmental problems, but have forgotten that, you know, in the absence of attention, the nuclear weapons enterprise has, you know, gone along its merry way, making weapons and profits.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, as you said, these, you know, you mentioned the term weapons of mass destruction there, which is always kind of a silly way to try to conflate mustard gas with an H-bomb, which could, of course, kill all of Houston, right? All of some massive city out there like that, or, you know, a huge chunk of the eastern seaboard, some of these larger multi-tens of megaton H-bombs that they have, that our enemies have, or our would-be adversaries like Russia and China have, that could just wipe our major cities completely off the map. And as you say, yeah, it's just kind of a issue in the background. Hardly anyone ever even talks about it. And they go on their merry way, as you say. Nobody really ever even questioning the policy, except for, it seems like, the worst people in the world, like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and all these, you know, so-called graybeard senior former State Department officials and Defense Department officials, they're coming together and saying, in a nutshell, hey, we actually know about these things, and before we die, we want to try to see if we can, you know, provide y'all a little wisdom now that it's too late, now that we don't have power anymore, and let's advise a severe reduction in nuclear weapons. But their cries are falling on deaf ears, right? Nobody even seems to notice them.
Well, that's the big concern. Absolutely. You know, how do you wake people up? People have, you know, so many concerns, and of course, in a mass consumption society, people have many trivial concerns as well. But how do you get them and the policymakers to address these issues? And one of the concerns, you know, that we found with New Mexico is, and you know, over the debate of about the B-6112 bomb. You know, was it really a full debate, or was it skewed by the power of the defense contractors and their allies, so that questions weren't raised? I mean, you know, if you look at it just the language, the idea that there are to be no new nuclear weapons with new military capabilities. Well, if you have a bomb that's a free-fall gravity bomb, and suddenly you make it a guided, accurate bomb, how is that not a new military capability?
Right. Yeah, sure sounds like it. But, yeah, again, they can do what they want. Laws are for little people, not for how the government is to operate, really, you know. And now, so this seems like an important talking point to use, too, is that Robert Gates' office put out a report saying we only need 14 nukes. That's enough to threaten any powerful nation state that they better not mess with us. But that's few enough that we're not really threatening all of mankind with extinction. So seems like a reasonable compromise for starters, right? 14. And it's a Republican former head of the CIA, Secretary of Defense under Bush and Obama, and neocon and realist seals of approval on him and everything, right?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that report, but I'll look at it.
Oh, yeah, it was the Office of the Secretary of Defense put out. Some Air Force generals wrote it up. I guess it would have been 2007 or 8. This could have been 8.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, when you get down to the low numbers of nuclear weapons, 15,000 is, I guess, something of a low number if you compare it to the 64,000 that were there. But And of those 15,000, some 92-93% of those are in the hands of the United States and Russia. So clearly, the U.S. and Russia are the countries that people should be focusing on to reduce the arsenals, as well as trying to, you know, keep other nations like Iran from joining the so-called nuclear club. The problem is that if the United States, one of the two nuclear superpowers, and arguably the one economic superpower left, if the United States is developing bombs that look like they are valuable and, you know, might be possibly, you know, considered in a conflict, then how are other countries going to react, both nuclear nation states as well as those who aspire to nuclear weapons? You know, if you say, hey, this is so valuable that we have to make it, then why not everybody? And that's a big concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, have they decided, is it a matter of consensus, or how do they decide whether they've achieved what they think is first strike capability, meaning the nullification of the mutually assured destruction doctrine? Because, you know, it's always argued, there's this one guy that's been commenting on my show entries for years and years, saying the same thing every time. As soon as we think we got first strike capability, that means that they have to launch on warning, the Russians, that they have to launch on an even lighter hair trigger than before if they even think something is wrong, because of the balance being tipped so far in that favor. Are we there yet? Is that right?
Well, I hope not. You know, one of the great, again, you know, unresolved issues is, you know, how many of the nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal are on alert, and on alert for what? You know, we've seen instances. There was 25 years ago, the launch of a missile in Norway that the Russians mistook for the beginning of a missile attack. Mm-hmm. They were very close to calling, you know, a retaliatory strike. I mean, you know, the world is too precious to have these kinds of risks there. I mean, if you care about a sustainable Earth, then you have to say we've got to get rid of nuclear weapons, and the best way to start is, you know, to reduce the arsenals. But of course, that goes against the interests, the profit sheets of the defense contractors, the bureaucratic interests of the Air Force and Navy, the nuclear arms in those branches of the service. You know, so you know there are a lot of countervailing forces that really have to be met by public opinion. And if the public is silent, then the military-industrial congressional complex is going to simply proceed, and the world is going to become ever riskier.
And now, could we end with that? Could you give us an example or two, a couple of the more obvious ones of the complex at work, that revolving door, Iron Triangle there, where politicians become lobbyists and all that kind of thing in this area?
Right. Well, my colleague Bert Hubbard did a really great job, and if your listeners go to the revealnews.org website, there's an interactive graphic that takes just six figures, who are part of the nuclear weapons enterprise, and shows all the various connections between the positions that they've held, and both in the defense industry as well as in the public sphere. So, for example, you have a congressionally appointed panel, 12-member panel, appointed by Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico, and not appointed by him, but he was the person who, along with John Kyle of Arizona, proposed that this panel be instituted. So the panel, half of the members of this panel have connections with the weapons lab. You know, the chairman of the panel was the former chairman of Lockheed Martin. So you've got this and they, of course, in their report, which was titled, interestingly enough, A New Foundation for the Nuclear Enterprise, essentially criticizes the National Nuclear Security Agency administration that's under the Department of Energy, criticizes it for being, in their words, dysfunctional because it doesn't have proven management practices. They basically are calling for less oversight of the nuclear enterprise, and that is good for the contractors, but what's good for contractors isn't necessarily good for the nation.
Yeah, in this case, couldn't possibly be worse, even if you were just making it up. I mean, we're talking again about H-bombs here. It's just, it's incredible. And you know, the fact of how alone you and your co-author stand in doing this kind of journalism is almost as shocking as what you report here. I mean, this obviously just kind of not even as a matter of opinion, right? It's almost a mathematical fact that assuming that the future of humanity's survival is important, then this is the most important issue facing all of us all day, every day, until they're all gone. Simple as that. What else could be more important, especially when it comes to our relationship with Russia, for example, this kind of thing? I mean,
well,
forget
again,
India
term,
and Pakistan.
Yeah, again, in the short term, you know, we're talking about the fast death. You know, there are other issues that are very important, and I applaud people who are engaged in so many socioeconomic issues. But, you know, when we're talking about the survival of the planet, we're really talking about nuclear weapons, the threat to survival. We're talking about nuclear weapons and climate change.
All right. Hey, listen, thanks very much for your time on the show. I sure appreciate it, Len.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. That is Len Acklin. And again, he was formerly the editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists magazine and wrote a book about the Rocky Flats nuclear bomb factory near Denver. And this article, very important article, really long, really worth the read, is at revealnews.org. Obama pledged to reduce the nuclear arsenal. Then came this weapon. Revealnews.org. And that's it for the show. Overtime. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks.